This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888, and today we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello, and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Michael Simmons, The Spectator's economics editor, and I'm joined today by The Spectator's US deputy editor, Kate Andrews, and Tej Parikh from the Financial Times. Globalization's obituary has been written many times before, but with the economic turmoil caused by Trump's tariffs over the past few weeks, we ask, is this the beginning of the end of globalization? And before we dive into that, let's hear from the man himself, Donald Trump.
If you don't make your product here, then you will have to pay a tariff, a very substantial tariff, when you send your product into the United States. I say the most beautiful word in the entire dictionary of words is the word tariff. I love tariff.
Right now, China's paying a 104% tariff. Now, it sounds ridiculous, but they charged us for many items 100%, 125%. Many countries have. They've ripped us off left and right. But now it's our turn to do the ripping. That's okay.
I don't want anything to go down, but sometimes you have to take medicine to fix something.
So, Ted, you've written about this in the Financial Times recently. Is globalization over?
I would say no. I mean, I think we have to look at things in a historical context. There's been many periods of protectionism ramping up only to eventually ebb away over a couple of decades at least. I think this isn't to make light of what's happening now. The proposals by the White House is certainly threatening. We've not seen protectionism like this on any scale. But the view that I was taking in my piece was to look at this over the long term. And ultimately, I see that the economic imperative of trading, you know, the low costs, the idea of producing what you specialize in, that eventually reasserts itself when you look at the long arc of history and protectionism.
Are we stuck in a world where we think goods are more important than they are? I mean, certainly for Britain, you know, we're a services economy. Is that true more globally, or do goods still really matter?
Goods matter, but services and the services trade, particularly digital services trade, are increasingly important. In fact, services trade and digital services trade has actually grown more rapidly than the goods trade. And this is what you see around the world, particularly as many countries develop. People shift their consumption patterns away from durable goods and non-durable items and into services. So buying financial services or indeed recreation services, entertainment. And our world is also becoming a lot less physical. You know, a lot of the products that we now purchase are digital and online. And so there can be a tendency for us to focus too much on the good side of things. And of course, Trump's protectionism is focusing primarily on the goods trade deficit.
And Kate, if we can bring you in, since you moved over stateside again with The Spectator, you've been in and out of the White House, I've noticed, a few press events. Have you worked out what Trump's ideology is here? I mean, is he arguing that globalization should be over?
It's an excellent question, Michael. Anyone who has figured it out and can confidently say that in 2 weeks' time it'll be the same deserves some kind of medal. This U-turn, this very serious pivot that he's done on the higher rates for tariffs, the pause for the next 90 days, you know, personally, I think is a very good thing and moving in the right direction, but it does raise very serious questions as to what the actual purpose of these tariffs are. If we go back to his first term, 2016 to 2020, this was a president who, when he used tariffs, was very clearly trying to use them to negotiate. And what seemed so fundamentally different in the Rose Garden last Wednesday, which feels like years ago, it was 1 week ago, was that Donald Trump, in his decision to use trade deficit figures and take away the dollar signs and put percentages on them and treat them like tariffs, was indicating that there wasn't going to be room for negotiation. There wasn't going to be room for America to pivot on this unless countries really decided that they were going to sell less to America or buy more from America. Neither option will be appealing, especially to developing countries that perhaps can't afford to buy American goods or don't need the same influx of American goods, and of course don't want to stop selling the products that they produce that Americans want to buy. This pivot suggests that he is very open to negotiation. And it's been interesting to see people like Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, who is really a believer in tariffs. He's fully signed up to the tariff cause, praising Donald Trump for this pivot, talking about the need to negotiate trade deals. And when we talk about trade deals, it's possible we're talking about winding back access to goods and products, but chances are we're probably talking about something in the free trade space. It remains incredibly unclear what the president intends to do, but what I don't think we should do is act as if this pivot means that we're out of the woods. You know, I completely agree that globalization is not going to come to an end simply because Donald Trump insists it's going to, but that's also my bias, is what I hope happens. I hope it continues. And I do need to check that. And I think the really big question about Donald Trump being in the Oval Office for 4 years, because he's not going anywhere, is the extent to which America decides to start to remove itself from that global trade scene. It's not going to stop China trading with African countries. That's only ramping up. It's not going to stop the EU from trading within and outside of those borders. But America removing itself would have massive implications. It would be so painful for American citizens, but as we just saw over the past week, it's going to be painful for the rest of the world. So let's not take this pause as something that we can breathe too heavy a sigh of relief, because it is a pause. Nobody knows what he's going to do next. And in the meantime, you have this baseline 10% tariff on practically every country, which makes America now one of the most protectionist countries in the developed world. That really wasn't the case a week ago.
Tej, you know, if we think about globalization and free trade and its history, I think, you know, most Financial Times readers, most Spectator readers and listeners to Coffee House Shots would agree that, you know, it's just an objective truth that free trade and globalization has, you know, brought huge wealth to, you know, the world's population. But this week it's come under, you know, serious attack. And whilst you both argue that, you know, it's not over, do you think that it needs to be reformed? And if it does need to be reformed, what direction does it need to go in the long run?
Yeah, I think globalization has been made a bit of a scapegoat. So it's entirely true that, you know, parts of the Rust Belt in the US have suffered from a loss of manufacturing jobs. That's undeniable. There are factory closures across America over the last few decades, and that has then exacerbated this cycle of economic decline. The question is the answer then that globalization needs to be reformed, or does policy that ensures that places and people can be agile and respond to economic change should also improve? And I think it's more of the latter, partly because globalization is an engine for massive wealth creation and allows people and countries to move up the value chain. Now, if the kind of reform is that we need to try and correct globalization in some way, you have to try and account for that loss of wealth creation that you get from globalization. Therefore, I think this is really a failure of governments to keep a pace with the change of markets and to ensure that markets at home are agile enough to respond. And by that, I mean things like the ability of people to retrain and upskill if they are made redundant in a factory, the ability for new buildings and businesses to sprout up because planning permits allow it to do so. Those are the types of things that I think the US and also in Britain have suffered from because of globalization. So I think the response to globalization, more than necessarily, you know, tweaking the globalization itself, is the answer here.
And Kate, do you agree with that? I mean, I think whatever we might say about Trump's prescription, has he diagnosed a problem?
He's diagnosed frustration on the part of plenty of American voters that they just feel insecure. They felt that Bidenomics and just that constant spending wasn't actually doing them any good. He very frequently puts his finger on the pulse about how people are feeling. But I'm not sure he's diagnosed a problem in this particular scenario with globalization and particularly trade deficits. I mean, I think, you know, the Spectator's gone into this a lot on different platforms. And just to put it very simply, a trade deficit is by no means inherently unfair. You can find plenty of examples, China included, where you have countries taking advantage of their trading partners. But the idea that you would have a goods deficit with another country is not inherently a bad thing, especially if these countries have people living at different levels of prosperity and wealth, have, you know, natural goods and resources specific to the region that other countries might want or need to use. It's not inherently bad. And I think that one of the great myths that has been peddled around protectionism, particularly within the MAGA movement, is that globalization, other countries, free trade is what obliterated your job, when we know that automation was a huge part of that. And when Donald Trump talks about bringing manufacturing back to America, he's quite right to compete in that space to try to get smart factories to start up in America. But do not assume that's going to come with a boom in manual labor jobs. You know, a lot of these factories look very, very different now, and they're going to be producing goods in a very different way. There will be room for some high-skilled jobs. There'll be room for some lower-skilled jobs, but it is not going to recreate the America of decades past. And to tell your voters, to tell your supporters that it is, I think is very disingenuous. And of course, if you do want to get smart factories to set up in Austin and Pennsylvania and across the country, then what you need to do is incentivize them. You need to be talking about lowering corporation tax. You need to be talking about the benefits that they'll have if they set up and invest in America. You should not be talking about barriers to trade. That's really not going to help the situation. So I don't think he has correctly diagnosed this one, but that is separate and different from the fact that Donald Trump has always been very good at relating to people who quite rightly feel like the system hasn't always been fair to them, and quite rightly feel like they've been looked over, particularly by Republicans and Democrats past, who had no real interest in going to rural Pennsylvania and speaking to those people until it was election time. Donald Trump, you know, if you go to one of his three-hour rallies, he loves talking to those people. He loves engaging with those people. And it might not make sense on the surface, but he does connect with them. And I think that's where, you know, people have been gravely mistaken to think that Donald Trump isn't tapping into something. But I don't think his diagnosis or his prescriptions for global trade have a lot of merit to them. And the fact that he has had to do this pivot is a pretty good indication that despite them saying that this was 4D chess, despite them saying that, you know, this was the plan all along, it so clearly wasn't. And perhaps there's been some kind of wake-up call, particularly within his cabinet, and different voices speaking up to say, if we keep going this way, it's going to be catastrophic for America.
And just before we finish, if I could ask the same big question to both of you, starting with Tej. Has the economic world changed forever, or is this just a blip that will be interesting history?
Yeah, I think, you know, even if Donald Trump reverses his protectionist agenda, you know, this 90-day pause stays, a pause that never happens, I do think that this event will live long in the memory. And unfortunately, it has at least affected the perceptions of economic credibility in America, and it might also make trading partners wonder whether, you know, the political discourse in the US might mean that this type of political situation might arise again even after Trump. So I think a lot of countries will still try and negotiate and engage in trade with the US on best terms, but I think the previous world in which there was a lot more trust and faith in the US system and its economy, I think that's been weakened.
And Kate, same question. Are we in a new world now?
I think I double down on Tedra's point that the rest of the world will be wondering to what extent it can count on America, not just because of what's happened this week with tariffs and economic turmoil, but because of foreign policy too. I mean, regardless of your views of, you know, what Europe says versus what MAGA says on Russia and Ukraine, it's very clear there's been a fundamental split, and you just cannot assume anymore that America and its allies, particularly in Europe, will take the same position. And I do think China is just this very interesting and very worrying question. I mean, in the short term, as these countries negotiate with America to try to get rid of these 10% tariffs, to try to avoid higher levies, they may well make all kinds of pledges about how they're going to decouple from China and, you know, isolate China, which does certainly seem to be a goal of the Trump administration. But in the medium term, in the long term, if you can't count on America, where are you going to look? The default is going to be the second largest economy in the world. And I think that's actually very worrying. Trump may have inadvertently given China some leverage by what he's done. And that's, you know, it's a counterintuitive statement because China is in a very bad place economically. The Chinese people are not in a good way. They're quite angry about the fiscal situation. Clearly, this 125% tariff is not a comfortable place for them to be. But in the medium term, if you can't rely on America, where are you going to go? And we've already seen hints of it. Rachel Reeves went to Beijing in January asking for some investment, and she got, well, I think a pitiful £600 million. But what if China increased that? What if they increased it substantially? If you can't count on America, is Europe going to say no?
Thanks, Kate, and thanks, Tej, and thank you for listening.